Welcome to the Systematic Understanding of Everything, an Exalted podcast. This show was a collaborative effort between the members of The Story Told, Bonus Experience, and Mage the Podcast. We're going to break down the basics of Exalted, from its rules to its setting. I'm Monica, 3rd edition supplement developer and lead mechanical developer for Exalted Essence.
I'm Terry Robinson, a producer and Exalted fan, and I learned 14 new words reading this book. Chaz could not join this evening as host because they had other engagements. Now joining us today to discuss today's topic, now on Indiegogo, Abyssals, Sworn to the Grave for Exalted 3rd Edition. Joining me today to discuss this product are the developers for it, Elliot, Vance, and Chaz. Thanks for joining.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, thank you for having us.
You've all done a number of interviews talking about how fun Abyssals are and their interesting romantic options and how they're rebels and sexy goth people, but this is Systematic Understanding of Everything. Let's get down to esoteric lore questions. What is the nature of death in Exalted 3rd Edition?
Opening with a little light, little light conversation starter.
Death in Exalted is kind of, wow, that's an incredibly big question to try and eat. Yeah, you stop being alive, your incapacitated level is filled with damage, and you start making a new character and complaining about
it. You choose not to take a dramatic injury, yeah.
Yeah, in creation, obviously, things die, and the real history of like death as it pertains to the Abyssals kind of traces all the way back to when the Exalted killed the Unkillable. That was kind of what they were made for. It was their first really big outing as a family. So Exalts kill some of the ancients, the things that are primordials that we don't call primordials for primordial reasons. They kill them, they die, and unlike everything else where death just kind of happened and the soul leaves and gets reincarnated and it's just a non-issue, these giant corpses just blowed up in this place called the Underworld, and it starts to accrete out from there. And so all of a sudden you've got these horrible, suffering tomb bodies of the slain creators of the world. And now ghosts are a thing. So yeah, that's death.
So are the Neverborn dead, or are they in some other state?
The Neverborn are dead and suffering.
I thought they weren't dead. They were just eternally dying.
Being eternally dying is being dead, but it's complicated. And trust me, I'm correct about that.
Have you got some new death-related credentials to share with us, Vance?
I do probate law.
Oh, okay.
That's, yeah. Where did the dead go then?
The dead go to all sorts of various little afterlives that have populated the underworld. That's one of the big things that we did in this edition that was really different. Before, the underworld was kind of just like a palette swap of creation. You go to the dark world version and everything is spooky, but somehow exactly the same. Because we were able to build and iterate off what people had done before, we got to do lots of like really fun local little afterlives. We made the executive decision death was going to be very moist now. So we've got this wonderful primordial sea of shadows, and all of these little afterlives kind of jut out of it as islands and mini continents. And the dead are kind of drawn there by the strange gravity of kind of this esoteric force that is part of what we call like the old laws. And sometimes you get drawn to a place because of how you died. Like if you are a murderer, you might end up in one of the afterlives that has some kind of gravitational pull for murderers. If you drowned, there's drowned afterlives. If you were struck by lightning, there are struck by lightning afterlives. Alternatively, the way that people in creation like pray to and worship the dead also helps to shape the underworld through that like ritual and prayer and memory and reverence. And so that also creates like cultural afterlives. So if you were from Wuzhan, you might be like drawn to their afterlife after you die, especially if you get like their cultural rites.
So since we've talked a whole bunch about the Neverborn and the way they shape the underworld, let's talk about what they want. Because one would presume that if you are an eternally dying titan, you're going to have some wants.
The Neverborn want it to stop. When you're eternally dying, it is really hard to form a coherent thought. So they might have gotten a sentence together in the full millennia they've been dead. But they want to stop being in this eternally dying spiral. They want creation gone. They want the underworld gone. They want to no longer exist so that they will no longer be suffering. They aren't able to really communicate or talk, so they aren't able to just give the Death Lords orders or give the Abyssals orders. So what the Death Lords have put together over the years is by plumbing the underworld, searching out lost lore, piecing together what they think the will of the Neverborn is into a code they call the Chivalry of Death. It sort of reinforces Abyssals being the Death Knights. And it's close enough to what the Neverborn want to work. It's not just kill everything, but it's sort of kill everything with style. They want you to kill the mighty before you kill the weak, so that you can sow despair by cutting down a city's champion in front of its people. They want you to tear down the borders between the living and the dead with things like Skullstone, where the Silver Prince has set up this whole necromantic society.
They want to sow suffering. I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
I would like to take a moment and talk about, like, that's some pretty antagonistic stuff. How do we do that in a game with, like, Solars or Dragonblooded? Like, what if someone doesn't want to buy into that idea? Is the answer, don't play an Abyssal, or...
No, part of the idea of the Abyssal has always included the renegade, the hot goth vampire who decides he doesn't want to serve Dracula anymore.
The Death Knight Errant is the term that we have here, which is...
If you try to fight against death chivalry... or push against sort of the nature of being an Abyssal, that's something where your great curse kicks in and dumps limit on you. But Abyssal limit is fun, and Abyssal limit is really different than other Exalted. They gain it more easily, they lose it more easily, and they don't have a permanent limit break at 10. Instead, when they hit 10, there's a dice roll, and the storyteller spins successes on various effects. It might manifest as sort of a deathly aura that kills all the cattle around you. If it's a weak manifestation, it might fill the sky with storm clouds. And really the idea there is not to punish people, but for the Abyssals who are going against type, fighting against being an antagonist, they have to deal with essentially a lot of spooky bullshit that causes problems for them, or that gives them cool ambiance for their brooding. And really, I want Abyssals to nourish everyone's inner goth and let it out. And I really like how the Great Curse works out with it.
The Neverborn are eternally dying. You made mention to the Deathlords. Do the Neverborn have agents? And how did they kind of get that position?
I guess the most powerful of the Neverborn's agents are the Deathlords. All of them are the ghosts of powerful Exalted from the past. Not just Solars, but other Exalts as well. We leave a lot of the exact backstory open, but lay in a lot of fun hooks for you to speculate and play with for each of the Deathlords about their history. But these are powerful ghosts who made pacts with the Neverborn to cast off their names and swear themselves to the Chivalry of Death in exchange for power, but also a kind of binding to the will of the Neverborn. And then they're kind of left to do what they can of the Neverborn's schemes, or not really the Neverborn's schemes, but the Deathlord's schemes in following the will of the Neverborn. So those are really the chief agents. There are lesser ghosts that are sworn to the Neverborn as well. There's a whole part of the underworld, the Labyrinth, that's full of ghosts sworn to the Neverborn. Other ghosts think it's scary and don't go there. These are the ghosts that are spooky to other ghosts, and they often serve and ally with the Deathlords as well. Sometimes they are more dedicated to the Neverborn even than the Deathlords are, but the Deathlords are more powerful, so you kind of get this interesting push and pull between specters and the Deathlords and all of those who are scheming the end of creation. But it turns out just destroying the world's kind of a bad gig, so a lot of the Deathlords are doing other stuff on the side, and that's where there's interesting room for stories.
The Death of Creation really has some Waiting for Godot vibes for it, or like the Death Lords are like the idea that at a Flat Earth convention, everyone there is actually a reporter undercover to report on everyone else at a Flat Earth convention or something like that. None of the Death Lords actually want to destroy creation except for one person. And all the other ones are like, yes, destroy creation. But first I need to create this telescope.
We kind of give a broad range of what destroying creation looks like to the Death Lords, from like the Lover who wants to destroy creation by breaking down one soul at a time into despair, to the Silver Prince, who is building his perfect society of the dead, where ghosts rule over the living, and the living wish only to be dead. It's a good step along the journey. To someone like the First and Forsaken Lion, who is like, this whole destroy creation thing? Nah, not doing this! And he got slapped down by the Neverborn for his hubris.
Where did the Abyssal Exotic come from? And they are, of course, the agents of the Death Lords. So tell us about the Death Lords and who picks them and, like, what kind of people do they select and how does that work?
The Death Lords kind of took on a big project, one of the only times that they really collaborated en masse, to find the Jade Prison that the Sidereals had used long ago to seal away the Solars. They were able to extract it due to all sorts of wonderful shenanigans involving the constellations of the Underworld and the development of these horrible little wonderful devices called the Monstrances of Celestial Portion. The Death Lords create these monstrances. They use them to kind of control a bunch of the solar exaltation that they released. Some of it goes to the Yozis instead, and some of it turns into the Solars who are wandering around creation as its newborn heroes. But a lot of that stays with the Death Lords. The numbers are a little bit fuzzy in this edition because it's one of those things that we want people to be able to dial in. But the important part is each of the Death Lords can use these monstrances to kind of usurp the part of the exaltation process where the sun normally gets to choose who deserves the solar exaltation. And they get to instead use that kind of power to choose their own Abyssal Exalted, who are kind of mainlining the essence of the Underworld, the essence of death itself, in all of its various shades and meanings. And so they appear to people who are dying, and they offer them a bargain, like, on their very last breath. It is, if you will serve me and serve my cause and serve death and the Neverborn, if you will subject yourself to the chivalry of death, throw away your name and live as our champion, then you can not only survive, you can have everything you want. You can have revenge, you can have power, you can have justice, for whatever that means for some people. You can have all of that, and all you have to do is help end the world and everything. And it's a bad bargain, but it's also a bargain made under duress, and it's a big, like, tragic bargain. And so all of the Abyssals are kind of dealing with the fact that they agreed to their own damnation, but they did it usually out of, like, survival, out of necessity, in, like, this moment of anger and disappointment in the world. And so how do they navigate that? How do they deal with that oath that they swore? How do they try and wiggle out of it or embrace it or do it in a way that fits their own personal morality and ethics?
So what are the castes of the Abyssals?
The castes of the Abyssals are dark reflections of the solar castes. So you have the Dusk caste, who are warriors and generals and murderers. You have Midnight, who are dark priests and orators. You have the Daybreak caste, who are savants and necromancers, crafters of terrible things. And you have the Day caste, who are assassins, thieves, stealthy types. And you have the Moonshadows, who are bargainers for the dead.
One of the coolest things about making your own Abyssal is that you get to come up with a sick title. You don't like the Death Lords, the Abyssals cast their names aside. First off, let's discuss a little bit about why. Why is that part of the deal? I'll let the developers discuss that. And then I think we should just come up with a couple cool things or share a couple that are from the book, because that's literally the most fun part. After finishing your character sheet, you're like, okay, but I am.
Abyssals sacrifice their names as part of their bargain with the Death Lords because they are giving up who they were when they were alive. They're no longer that person symbolically. And if they try to fight against that, if they try to live among the living as one of them, if they acknowledge the name they had in life, the Great Curse comes down and makes life hard for them. It is a lovely thing to angst about when someone you knew and loved calls you by your name and you have to pick between answering them and not suffering. And it gives you an excuse to pick up the coolest title you can think of for your character. Some examples, I think, are... we have the Maiden of the Mirthless Smile, the Seven-Degreed Physician of Black Maladies, the Falling Tears Poet. So these aren't names. Like, some exalted may give themselves a new name after exalting. They are titles bestowed upon the Abyssals by the Death Lords. And you can tell it's a title and not a name because it usually has a V in front. Although that's not universal, we've got a weeping Rhyton cast aside, all clad in tatters came the Mendicant Knight. So you get a little funky with your title.
We talked about the names and titles. What can the Abyssals do? Is it just all solar charms, but with the word blood at the beginning?
It is not. I think this is one of the coolest things that we've done with Abyssals this edition, is we really expanded Abyssal charms to cover weird aspects of death and take a lot of inspiration from the Death Lords. So while there are definitely core ability charms that reflect the solar versions, all of the charm abilities have just wild death flavored stuff that the Abyssals get to do. And it was a lot of fun writing and developing those charms.
Do you have any favorites?
I've got like a dozen, but I'll limit it. The Archery Essence 5 Capstone, which you can still get early on because you have an apocalyptic ability. It's called Last Day's Portent. You shoot an arrow at the sun and it goes out. And it is nighttime. Over in Medicine, there is Stitched Flesh Champion, where you've already mastered making Frankensteins and zombies. Now you have one particular special Frankenstein that is your baby. This is your special custom-made corpse monster, and you are going all out with it. You are obsessing over it.
There's Seven Edges of the Rhyton in Stealth that lets you summon primordial knife things that come out of your shadow and attack for you. There is also, I think, some really cool craft charms where you can instill curses and compulsions into the things that you make. So if you want to, like, give something that will turn everybody into a golem from Lord of the Rings and obsessing over their precious, like, we've got craft charms to do that.
I'm going to be a little bit partial to some of the spooky things that we get to sneak into Sale, which is historically not a super sexy ability, but now you can use it to, like, spread rumors of your dread arrival or wreathe your ships in horrifying underworld hazards.
So one of the things that happens is these are kind of matched up with Death Lords, seemingly. There are fewer Death Lords than there are abilities to tie them to. What happens to the other one? Is there kind of like an open space to play with, or?
So each ability takes inspiration from two or three Death Lords. So each Death Lord is represented in more than one ability. When we talk about Death Lord charms, this is really in the inspiration space. We think about which abilities kind of match up with the MO of a particular Death Lord, and that just lets us have particular flavor to the way we're writing the charms. So it doesn't tie you to having learned that from that Death Lord. We don't go through and say, oh yeah, this is a lover charm, and this is a dowager charm, and this is an iron seven spares charm. It's kind of something fun that you can go and see if you can figure out our inspirations for it, but we don't write that on the tin. I think it was almost more an inspirational tool for us as writers and developers to figure out what direction to take each ability.
So let's talk about necromancy. There's obviously, this is their wheelhouse. I think we maybe should discuss a little bit how it compares to sorcery, what it does differently, what sort of new things we're introducing in this.
Yeah, I will never not want to talk about necromancy or sorcery or any of that. So for necromancy, it is like this big system of manipulating essence. And in this case, it's manipulating essence into a pattern that is like death and like the underworld and like the Neverborn and even like the old laws. So it's weird. It's made out of like ritual and memory and the same substrate as the underworld itself. One of the cool things that it does is it just gives you another way to access big singular effects like sorcery does, but they're all kind of seen through the lens of the underworld and those various influences. We knew that we didn't want it to be, as it has kind of sometimes been in the past, just like sorcery, but smaller and spooky. There've always been a lot of like necromancy spells that only work on ghosts, and we wanted it to be stuff that really felt like it had its own identity. So in this edition, necromancy still has three circles that you go through. And as you like get deeper and deeper into necromantic lore, you can start doing all sorts of weird, awful spells. The big trade-off that you get with necromancy is you lose out on summoning demons and elementals, which are hands down like the biggest tools in any sorcerer's toolkit. But in exchange, you get a lot of like weird, spooky stuff, especially like some combat time level summoning, or like creating masses of creatures and animating all sorts of awful shambling messes, or like breathing out a legion of hungry ghosts. Also, things where you do like a conceptual murder, like you murder fire in the range of the spell and fire just can't exist there anymore. It's a very bad time to be a fire elemental if someone throws something like that at you. Mechanically, we still got the spells that are unique to necromancy, but we do kind of give it permission to adapt some sorcery spells, and some sorcery can sometimes adapt necromancy, but it's always going to be in a way that like feels good or accurate to what it's doing.
Okay, so we've talked about the cool stuff they do and what makes sorcery separate. Kind of reading through the manuscript on this, it kind of departs from the other books that we've gotten so far in kind of two minor ways. One, often we get kind of a new layer of creation, but in this case, we get a new place, the underworld. The other thing is, you have to get four chapters in before it's character creation, because there is so much of a milieu to understand beforehand. And one of the key aspects of that is the fact that you are, unlike the Solars, which are just, well, the realm's against you. Have fun there, buddy. You are born. You are created. The second breath is delivered unto you, and you are immediately in a political milieu. What are kind of the political factions that you can be as an abyssal? Like, we talked about the bronze and we talked about the gold faction for the sidereals. What kind of existing cleavages are there in the world of abyssals that characters get to choose to interact with?
So I think abyssals kind of gives you a neat middle ground between the really structured society that you have in Dragonblooded, where you're tied to house and family and empire, or the totally on your own, you have the friends you make along the way aspect of the Solar Exalted. Instead, you are sworn to service to a particular liege lord. And so your liege has schemes, plots that they're doing, your death lord. They have other servants. And so you're in this position where you are one of a small number of important champions for a mega powerful ghost who also really needs you to do stuff for them. And so this is one of the other changes that we kind of made for third edition, is exactly the inflection point in this relationship between Abyssal and Deathlord, where in the past the Deathlord was this being so far above you that they were commanding and you were a servant. Now there's more of a negotiation there, where because you are exalted, you are powerful. That is one of the things we've done in third edition, is that you are never the bottom of the stack. You are always someone important as one of the exalted. And so you are important to the Death Lord. So yes, they are going to push you to do things for them and encourage you to drive their schemes forward. But they're going to do it in a way that aligns with your interests. They're going to tempt you with favors. They're going to support your own schemes. There then can be kind of the politics and favor play between you and the other abyssals of your Death Lord. So there's a lot of stuff there.
And does the Death Lord you are engaged in this liege lord relationship, do you kind of automatically have friends and enemies based on what Death Lord you pick for your character during creation?
Each Death Lord is already sort of wrapped in their own web of alliances and rivalries and vendettas. They've been at this for 1,000-odd years, and the Abyssals have only been around for the last 5. So there are whole hierarchies of ghostly servants the Death Lords had who've now been kicked down one step to make way for the Abyssals, which is going to breed a lot of conflict within the Death Lords' own sort of individual factions. There are rivalries between the Death Lords. The Bishop of the Chalcedony, Thurible, considers himself to be a very pious and fanatical follower of the Neverborn, and any Death Lord who doesn't really live up to his standard for that, he is in opposition with. Death Lords who do live up to that standard, like the Lover, he's still in opposition with, because they have been caught up in this long-running argument over how best to do it. So that's the kind of thing you can just fall into. You can be a Circle of Abyssal sent out by the Bishop to do something in order to prove a point to the Lover, and end up having to interact with her abyssals and maybe form alliances of your own with them, form rivalries, and just get really messy.
Stygia is kind of the capital that the underworld doesn't have. It is the biggest city of death. It is like the cultural center. It has spread its influence throughout creation, so it's now the cultural afterlife for a lot of other afterlives too. Stygia is a great, wonderful place to play in, maybe not always to be in, because it is still a city in creation and adjacent realms with all of the problems that implies. Stygia, as a big power, is home to these really enigmatic beings called the Dual Monarch. And so the Death Lords and some other underworldly powers actually conspired to conquer Stygia. And so it is kind of an alliance of these 13 powers that combined, rather than kind of running over one another to try and get the loot, they decided to split it amongst themselves. So now Stygia is technically ruled over by the Sumerian Council and the Stygian Pact, to which there are like 13 signatories. Some of the Death Lords are direct signatories to it. Some of them have like cat's paw agents who are like in line with them. Some of the Death Lords just don't really care. Like the bishop isn't really huge about it. And then a lot of the other powers are either candidates that you could promote to Death Lordhood if you wanted, or they're just really cool ghostly powers. Like my favorite is probably Fathom Hermit Shell, who is the signatory for a like league of underwater ghosts. And they just kind of present as like this big suit of bronze, and no one knows what's inside. And I choose to believe that it looks like the Scooby-Doo, like, old-timey diver bell in my head. Don't tell Eric, but that's what I see. And nothing can change that.
What is it? Ferai Zoyun of Dis, the Coalition of Pre-Human Ghosts? I just like that as a sentence, because that's a thing you get in Exalted.
You do get some fabulous sentences in Exalted.
Very true. One of the, it's number one best qualities. Let's talk about the new take on the underworld, because this is also probably one of my favorite things that the book did, just as someone who also contributed to it. I didn't develop it, but I did, was a contributing author. And like, in previous editions, I would say that I found the underworld boring and a place that wasn't interesting to explore or go to, because it was either like, yes, it's just creation, but negative flipped, or it was like, and you can't respire essence and everything there wants to eat you. And it's just like, okay, so why would I ever go there? Why would I ever go there? And now we've given a reason for people to want to go there and to have campaigns there and stuff like that. I think that's great. So like, let's talk about some new info on the underworld.
Why is there a big sword there?
Because big swords are rad as hell. One of the really cool things that we got to do with the underworld this edition, a lot of previous editions kind of did that thing where they wrote about the underworld as a monolith, or almost as if each direction was a monolith. Like, this is how people bury their dead and worship them in the north or in the south. And then you actually sit and do the like math on how big each of the directions in Exalted is. And you just kind of go, something is up there. So we were able to really lean into what I think one of the big strengths of third edition's setting writing is, which is that we want to make places feel cool by making world building local. So we've got lots of really interesting specific locations that help to give people like a sense of what the underworld is like. We can invite you to make your own places, and we can give you some places to start with that are going to take the heavy lifting off you to get started. But we're also just creating room for you to tell all these interesting little stories. We've got plenty of really wonderfully weird places. We have the big ass sword, Kesendang. Basically, it is an afterlife for glory seekers. And the higher you go, the harder it gets to go any higher, until eventually you get to the city at the top of the sword and you find out that it's a wonderful like paradise. But also that paradise only happens because of like the adversity that is inflicted on all the people lower down the sword. So it's a little bit of a stolen joy. We also take you through some really cool places, like Dari of the Mists comes back, and we wanted that to have its own identity. And so it became a place that was an afterlife for debtors, where congratulations, you died because you were in debt to someone. So now you're going to be in debt to a morally questionable to utterly horrific company who's going to try and keep you in peonage for basically as long as they possibly can. And we were able to get a lot of really interesting stuff out of that. But ultimately, what I think is the most fun with the underworld is we've got some shorter write-ups for places like Sky Pavilion, which is the afterlife for the Varang city-states, who are all about like, you have to live everything according to astrology. And so their ghosts wanted to do the same, but the underworld has really shitty stars. So they actually like put up their own fake sky that recreates the constellations that they're used to, and they're having to struggle to keep that running. Or we have all of these wonderful little seeds that are really like trying to get people to go there. One of them is there's like a city that sometimes appears that's like a chandelier hanging from the sky of the underworld, where all of the ghosts there are unable to communicate. And sometimes the lover goes there to study. And if she's had a really good day, maybe she'll unmake one of those ghosts because their life is that much suffering. There's just all sorts of wonderful little locations like that, wonderful little details, places that make the underworld feel local and specific, that you could like plop down, to get your mind racing to go and visit them.
I like Unnameable, the Leviathan metropolis, which is Brigadoon, but for the dead.
Brigadoon.
It's probably one of the things I'm most excited about the companion for, is getting to expand on the underworld, because the underworld is like all new this edition. There's not a lot of past edition where we can point and say, hey, here's more underworld stuff for you if you want to expand on it. So there's a lot of space for us to add pretty big sections of the underworld, connect to more afterlives of creation. So I'm really excited about doing that when we get there.
But you also do a good job in this book of outlining this is how being dead work, where you lay down that basic metaphysical foundation. We were like, this is how we treat grave goods. This is how offerings are treated. This is what you can still get there. We don't get a mention of grief bees. So I assume that's going to come in the expansion. Grief bees.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Grief bees?
Grief bees.
Grief bees.
Yeah. Grief bees. It's not even hyphenated. Grief bees.
Make the sad honey.
Yeah, they make the sad honey.
Oh, from Zalrath.
It is fleshed out as a fully operable place that has its own political blocks, and then you have the division between how you died and where you died, and I assume there's just a little bit of randomness in where people wind up. Does the calendar of Satesh still exist?
Yes. In fact, it played an important role in the Death Lord's scheme to steal the Exalted souls, because they manipulated the calendar of Satesh to steal a constellation from creation's sky where the Jade Prison was housed in this edition. So, even more important than in the past.
Nice. So, Abyssals is the sixth large Exalt type that is fully out in the world via Exalted Essence. We got them all. You can play Megatron if you want to. But this is the sixth one where we got the full main book. What kind of learnings made their way into Abyssals from the previous books? Like, what has the experience so far in Exalted? How has that resulted in kind of the Abyssal product we see?
I guess for me, part of it has been just the beauty of delegation. I think I did less work on Abyssals than any book previously, and I love it because we've got other people to do things, which is great.
Did you write merely 70% of the charms, or?
Less than 50%.
Yes! Another lesson is really sort of a pulling out and looking at various mechanics and also aspects of the setting as parts of one big system. With Abyssals, we've got the Great Curse, the Chivalry of Death, the Death Lords, and their charm set sort of coming together in a way that reinforces that experience of you are this tragic, Byronic, hot vampire Bishonen hero. What are you going to angst about? Who are you going to kill?
Some of it is just getting to pull some of the same glow up that we did, hopefully for you, Sean, being able to share some of that with the underworld, which is, since we didn't have to completely invent everything, we really wanted to sit down and focus on playability, making these spaces that have lots of hooks, making lots of things that players could like bounce off of for their character concepts or their histories or their motivations. And I think that's probably one of the things that I'm most proud of with the setting, is how much we've really focused on usability at the same time that we've also tried to like be weirder and more specific and more vivid. We've also always really tried to keep things playable, like, because it is a game first and foremost.
Chaz, what was it like being a developer?
Oh boy, it was exciting. I learned a lot on this book, and in terms of just like how to approach developing. I remember the lessons. I have very little memory of the actual process, because core writing and development was while my daughter was 0 to 6 months old. It was kind of a wild time for me while we were writing this book. But I think some of the key important stuff that I got out of it was thinking structurally. In the outlining and development phase, we went through a lot of iterations of how do we put together the underworld chapter, because we gave a bunch of different writers a bunch of different pieces. And then we're like, oh God, how does this chapter fit together? And so Elliot did the lion's share of the work there in restructuring every time we had a conversation about, like, how do we get this material to flow and fit together? And from the way you're talking about the manuscript, it sounds like we did a good job there. That was one of the things where, going into the next book that I was working on, I thought a lot more about how is the structure of this chapter going to come together when it is assembled from multiple assignments. That was something I took out of it. And then, boy, are there a lot of charms developing a charm book. I cannot imagine doing that on my own, as Vance has had to do for most of the rest of the edition. Being able to collaborate and bounce back and forth with charm development was a really cool development experience.
I mean, 25 abilities, 25 charms per 625. How long? You just do one a day for almost 2 years. Monica, you got to write for it. Any thoughts as a writer?
This was a small assignment for me. It was at a time where I was pretty busy. So I wrote the Shadowlands section, and I wrote a handful of charms, a bunch of high-end integrity charms. I can always be trusted to be sort of handed an ability and be like, come up with some really ridiculous shit for endgame play. And I'm like, gotcha, fam. And that's always fun. I did a Weeping Rite and Cast Aside, and then I wrote the chapter fiction for the charms chapter, which I will never not say yes to doing. I will always say yes. I like to double negative because I think it's funny. I love writing chapter fiction so much. I love writing chapter fiction, especially exalted chapter fiction. I love being handed 600 words and a prompt that's sometimes nearly as long as the assignment and being like, okay, cool. I will in fact include all of these things. I guess I can toot my own horn. I think all of my chapter fictions are bangers, and this one's included. So yeah, it was fun. I always have fun working on exalted stuff.
Speaking of banging chapter fiction, who chose the Albert Camus quote at the front? Because props to that. That's all I'm saying.
What was the Camus quote?
There is only one liberty to come to terms with death. Thereafter, anything is possible. And then the guitar fucking plays automatically because Camus is a badass. Sorry, I'm a big fan of Albert Camus.
I consider myself
an absurdist.
It was, because it definitely wasn't me.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't Vance, and it wasn't me. Unless it incepted itself into the manuscript.
The quote came before the book, the Neverborn of quotes. So we've run through our list of questions for people who are interested in backing. Go to Indiegogo. That will be available thence after. If you don't make it in time, you lose some of the backer benefits, but you can still get most of them, and eventually...
The entire text of the book is available now, however. One of the things of Indiegogo is it does not have backers-only updates, so the entire manuscript is publicly available during the course of the campaign if you want to see what we're doing with it.
I encourage people to go read it and then back it. Take a look and know what you're getting into, which is some really cool shit.
Is there anything that you felt like you haven't been able to hype up enough on what's in here? Maybe a weird bit of lore or something that existing exalted heads may strongly gravitate to?
Deathlord boss fight. In the NPC section, one of the writers gave us absolutely boss fight tier stats for the First and Forsaken Lion, and they are a monster on the battlefield. I think people are going to be real happy with that. I hope we get to do a bunch more Deathlords in the companion book.
Have you already answered the obligatory, who's your favorite Deathlord?
Favorite Deathlord is hard. I will probably have to say the Princess Magnificent with lips of coral and robes of black feathers, also known as the Black Heron. Not just because she is a bird Deathlord. My favoritism of Princess Magnificent predate my fandom of birds.
So my favorite today is the Dowager, who is just so cool. She is a gigantic bloodborne boss sitting over a cauldron in which there are maybe other worlds. She's so cool. I love her.
Also, she sealed the fucking deal. She almost killed all of creation. She doesn't do that thing. We don't get exalted. People are like, oh, the Mask of Winter. She's on Godzilla. Who cares? She killed everyone. The answer to the question of, did the Dowager kill this person, statistically is yes. No one else gets to say that.
He makes a compelling argument. I think the Eye is probably my favorite, just because he got such a glow up this time around. We took out a lot of his ick, and the writer just replaced it with absolute, awesome, insane, mad scientist vibes that are just a whole lot of fun to imagine playing as one of their Death Knights. just because all of the Death Lords are bad bosses in very different ways. Except the Walker, who in my headcanon is a very good boss, but no one can take him seriously because of his Time Lord hat.
The note I have for that is Necrotech crossed out, and the word next to it is Ghost Punk. So I like that as an aesthetic that may be able to exist.
Terry, do you have a favorite Death Lord?
Do I? I think I was pleased by the eye, because there's despair, there's wanting to destroy the creation, and then there's wanting to weaponize the Neverborn. And being like, well, they're stuck in Eternal's Torment, probably not going to mind if I just, you know, take off a piece of their infinite god body. The duality that seemingly none of them actually want the destruction of creation, and all of them have a different MO, as you mentioned. Like, they are each different villain types in the large open world From Software version of Exalted. So I thought that was pretty well done.
Monica, do you have a favorite Death Lord?
I mean, it's always really been the Walker, but I think I have to give the Mask and the Silver Prince my award for best turnaround. You've already kind of talked at the eye, which also, like, up here, and then, like, they're the next two. I really like the reimagining of the Mask of Winners as this. It's sort of canonizing his caddy game.
Yes.
I like that so much. Always there, just, like, written by an actual gay person this time, and so it lands way better.
With that, if we're interested in finding out what you're doing, Monica, if you have to go, do you want to go first?
I'm still working on Exalted stuff. There's going to be some good news soon, I hope, as far as things relevant to me and my contributions to Exalted go. I am on Tumblr at Dice-Wizard. I'm also on Blue Sky at Dice-Wizard. I post on Tumblr. I don't post on Blue Sky, but you're welcome to follow me in both places. You can also listen to the back catalog of my other show, Bonus Experience, at bxpcast.com.
Vance?
Right now, I am finishing up some drafts for Exigence, the Companion, and thinking some thoughts about alchemicals. You can find me in a state of despair.
Elliot?
I am currently also finishing up some drafts for probably an unwise number of projects in Exalted and otherwise. You can find me in the, like, Onyx Path Discord or the Exalted Fan Discord. Don't follow me on the bloated pustulant corpse of Twitter.
Speaking of things that are eternally dying and will not actually die. Yes.
I'm theoretically on Blue Sky as E. Freeman, but I have done absolutely nothing with that. So if people just randomly start following me, maybe that will convince me to post, knowing me, probably just photos of the word redacted.
And Chaz, how about you?
I think mostly migrated my social media over to Blue Sky, where I am at President of Birds. I am also on Tumblr as at President of Birds, but post there less now. You can all find me on many Discords, and I do give permission for people to at me politely if you really want my take on something. I may not get to it right away, but I do not have time to follow all of the Discord conversations all the time, so that's a good way to summon my presence. What am I working on? Exigence Companion. Did some cool stuff for that. Really happy with what I wrote there. Developing the Sidereal's Companion, which is now in first drafts. I hear some air horns in the editing soundboard.
I forgot. It's been a while since I've inserted sidereal air horns.
And generally thinking about fun Exalted stuff. Oh, and I actually recorded a session of my next Exalted actual play this week. I can't say when that is going to release, but we are recording again. So it is really happening.
And you can follow me at Terry Robinson on Twitter. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And thank you for writing Abyssals.
And thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Systematic Understanding of Everything, an Exalted podcast. Go to exaltcast.com to subscribe, see our show notes, or listen to our past episodes. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and Anchor.fm. If you have a question, shoot us an email at questions@exaltcast.com. If you'd like to support our show, please consider using the affiliate links in our show notes to make purchases on DriveThruRPG and TheStorytellerVault.com. The opening theme is Return of the Solar Exalted, and the closing theme is the Sidereal Exalted Lesser But Safe from Fanfare for the Chosen by James Semple, and is used with permission. In the meantime, exalt strong.
I was describing Abyssals to someone, and they said they were incapable of telling the difference between Abyssals and Italy during the pre-unification period under Pope Pius IX, which is the most esoteric response I've ever gotten. So now I really want to back at the you get to name a depth lord and have Pope Pius IX in there. But I already forgot what you said. I've been very sick this week.
Sworn to the grave.
Before we get started, I would like to introduce the newest of the Graveborn, Henry Kissinger. Sorry, I had to do it.
Unfortunate this isn't a video show because everyone's face is...
It's just a gem. Periodic reminder from Systematic Understanding of Everything. Get a will. Which one is Henry Kissinger?
Moonshadow.
Yeah.
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 Elliot's like, why did we hire this idiot?
No, that's just resting contempt face. I can't help it.
It's the Death Lords who aren't all Solars. The Abyssals are all Solars.
Okay. I'm sorry. Got it. So we don't get Goth Straw Maiden Janist in a supplement down the line. Got it.
You do right. Get Goth Straw Maiden Janist in Exigent. He added a sidebar.
Vance, I don't think a sidebar is enough. I'm kind of sold on Goth Janist now.
Yeah, 50-foot tall Goth Janist. High school Terry would be super into that. That's all I'm saying. Hi.
I'm kind of in love with the idea of an Exigent Death Lord, though.
Yeah.
Three devs, y'all agree to it, it's canon. I'm just going to say Corpse Engines of Annihilation. I have a lot of friends who would probably be into their first album if that were a real thing. Mm-hmm. So amen to that.
I feel like I went to a Corpse Engines of Annihilation show when I was in college.
Yeah, Abhorrence of Breath opened for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jackal Who Feasts Upon Lies. Again, someone I dated in high school.
Touring with Cradle of Filth.
Yeah.
I love their album, The Harrowing Scythe of Azedithe. They got really conceptual there.
You lost me on that one. I prefer the more straightforward Scandinavian work of Husk Flayer. So it's so hard to tell what I'm going to cut and not. I love this show.
A lot less existing cleavage since we took Maiden of Mirthless Smile off the cover. Anyway.
Was that the one you previously referred to as the fuck ghost?
No, that was the lover glad in the Raven of Tears. You know, Stabby McBone Boobs, who was on the cover of the Abyssals with her honking bazongers with the two skeletal hands holding them up. Anyway.
Terry ruins Exalted again.
I don't know if I'd call that ruining it.
I did notice that General Diablery of the Legion Sanguinary has real Gilbert and Sullivan vibes to it. Yeah. I also like that people from Skullstone are called Skullfolk.
You call them Skullstoners.
Scullies, the Skullish.
You got Skullstoned! I also, the line, Dream That Walks shows great interest in the Immortal City's customs, odors, and bells. I just like that they're a well-rounded person. And these are all my ways of proving when you send me the manuscript, I read the damn thing. Abyssals, brought to you by OXO.
That was dumb. Cut that, because I have no idea what that actually means.
I nodded along very seriously.